Greetings from Long Time No See, the podcast. Every week, we'll be inviting two blindfolded comedians to answer a series of questions about their careers, lives, and opinions. Now, let's remove those blindfolds and start the show.
Hi!
What would your opening line with your celebrity crush be?
Loved you in Harry Potter.
Worst date you've been on?
A man bit my neck mole off once.
You did what?
A man bit my neck mole off.
Oh my God, Jack almost fell off his chair.
Be sure to follow and subscribe to the podcast.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Consequence Podcast Network. Welcome to In Defense of Ska. We aim to push back on the mainstream's negative perception of the music. Ska deserves the respect genres like punk, hip-hop, and hardcore find among their listeners. Our host is renowned music journalist and author of the book In Defense of Ska, Aaron Carnes.
Today we speak with Jawbreaker drummer Adam Faller. Jawbreaker formed in the 80s, originally while the members were students at New York University. They later relocated to Los Angeles and then relocated again to San Francisco. There they found a home among the bubbling punk scene at Gilman. Their unique songwriting style, which would impact many younger indie and emo bands, was beloved by the scene. Following in the footsteps of fellow Gilman band Green Day, who signed to a major and blew up, Jawbreaker signed to Geffen. They famously received immense backlash from fans for selling out. However, time has shown their sellout record, Dear You, to be a timeless classic, one that their fans now love. Their 2017 reunion as Riot Fest headliners showed that they were innovative and always worked with integrity. And now, joining me is my co-host, veteran ska musician Adam Davis of Omnigon and Link 80.
I would have never guessed that we would end up with somebody from Jawbreaker on this podcast. I mean, what's the ska connection to Jawbreaker?
Well, I think that's the thing. Jawbreaker didn't play ska or anything, but I met Adam and he told me that he liked the Untouchables and saw Untouchables play when he was a kid. So it just kind of goes to show that we think of ska in this very narrow world. Like, these are the people that are part of ska. These are the people and not. But people who you wouldn't think have a connection to ska or at least enjoy the music.
Yeah. And I mean, I'm always happy to talk to other bands from the East Bay, other bands from the Gilman Street scene. I think it's a really cool location to be from. And it really does influence all the music, just the location.
Forever, you know, Gilman's always going to have a connection to ska and ska's development because of Operation Ivy and the role that it played. That's, you know, and also its role in being the cover of my first edition. Very important ska history there.
That too. Yeah. I mean, we really do aim to show people who wouldn't expect that there's, you know, some connection to ska, how important the music is and how much it is spread through the culture.
When you and I met, you had told me that you grew up in like Hermosa Beach or Santa Monica or something like that. And that you were a fan of the Untouchables.
Yeah, I was. I'm from Los Angeles. I've been in San Francisco for like over 30 years, so I kind of feel like a local here now too. But yeah, I spent the first half of my life in Los Angeles. I was born in Hermosa, and I lived all over the West Side, Santa Monica, Palisades. But yeah, I was. I went to see the Untouchables right when they started playing. I went with my sister and we saw them. It was either Christmas Eve or New Year's Eve in 81 or 82, I think, at the Roxy or the Whiskey. I can't remember which. It was so long ago.
They had a residency in their early days at the Roxy, so high probability it was the Roxy.
That was probably it. And I remember time thinking this was the first sort of American version of that second wave. And it was really great. It was really fun. And I never, I don't think I saw him again after that. A friend of mine that I went to high school with called Susie, was tight with those guys. And I used to see him kind of running around on their Vespa, all over the West Side and there in the beach and stuff. And, yeah, super, super stylish.
What did they look like driving around? What was that visual like?
It was just rad because it felt like it was sort of out of time in a way. I remember kind of clocking it and thinking that's punk rock, but it's something else, obviously. Mm-hmm. But I never really got too hung up on, kind of the genre thing. I never really felt like I was, I should hold back and not, get into certain things, just because it wasn't punk, right? That, when hardcore got really popular, it was sort of, it got a bit Stalinist and that, you couldn't dare to have an ABBA record or something,
Right.
Or listen to metal or reggae or I never really had that problem.
So in 81, when you went to the show, what was the stuff you were into mostly?
I was just getting into punk. At that time I was listening to, all the stuff that the seminal things that you have to kind of go work through to get to wherever you are in the timeline. So I was probably listening to the Clash and the Pistols and the Ramones and, Black Flag and X, and all that stuff. But like I said, it was I never felt like, I needed to curate my taste in any kind of rigid way. I mean, it sounds like a brag. I'm sure most people don't feel like they have to do that, but there was a certain point where it just wasn't cool to listen to a certain kind of music. And
sure.
I always thought that was bullshit that, of course I'm going to listen to Led Zeppelin and I'm going to listen to Bob Marley and, whatever. That didn't seem punk to me because, Joe Strummer and D. Boone taught us that, that's not how we do it out here.
When I got into music, when I was growing up in the late 80s, early 90s, I kind of thought of all underground music as one thing, even though it was stylistically all different.
Yeah.
So it would be like, I didn't really parse it out like this is punk, this is ska, this is funk or whatever. It was like, there's the radio music and then there's the underground music. And I like the underground stuff. That was kind of how I approached it as a kid.
Yeah. Yeah. Me too. And I was into AM radio hit golden, hits as well. Like that's where I learned about hip hop was from, AM radio.
Sure.
How did that work? How did you learn about hip hop from AM?
Cause they were playing, when Sugar Hill Gang came out, that's where that was getting spun like fucking every hour on the hour. And that was just on my shitty transistor.
Yeah.
I can't even remember what the station was down there. Maybe like 93 KHJ or something, but they were playing that stuff. And that's how that was, my intro to hip hop or rap music, I guess they called it back then.
Sure.
Were you going to a bunch of shows in the early 80s down in LA?
Oh yeah. We were lucky. I'm a man of a certain age. So I'm born in 66. So in 1980, I'm 14 and starting to get, kind of develop my own taste in stuff. And being in LA, we were lucky because every big band that came through played LA. And we also had a thriving underground scene, that we could explore every single weekend. It was like, so when I was in 10th grade or 9th and 10th grade, it was like every, you know, everyone was playing every weekend. You could go see one of those SST bands or Channel 3 or whoever. And then you had, you know, then you could also go to the forum and see AC/DC or whatever. Mm-hmm.
Quick sidebar really quick. Have you noticed living in the Bay now, currently, tours are kind of skipping over the Bay Area?
Yes, I noticed that just the other day. I was looking at a band put their routing up on Instagram, and I noticed that it was sort of like they might have even had a Sacramento show and then and then an LA show, but nothing in San Francisco or Berkeley, which says a lot. That's a drag. I wish it wasn't that way. It seems like the really major huge bands that come through, mm-hmm. We'll play like the Chase Center, I guess now. But I mean, that said, I've been going to a lot of shows. I just went and saw, the Linda Lindas last night with the Illuminati Hotties.
Yeah, over at Regency.
Yeah, that was great. I went and saw Sad Snack at the Kilowatt. With the Abruptors the other night as well. Band, I think they're from back east, the Abruptors.
Mm-hmm. Buffalo.
That was great. It just seems like there's been a lot of shows, and then you Built to Spill the other night right around the corner from me at the Chapel. So I don't know, if you look hard enough, you can find stuff to do here. But I did notice like a conspicuous absence of SF shows for some bands that I thought would definitely hang here.
Yeah, something that I've been noticing too. And I think you also kind of touched on, I mean, you just brought up three shows. I feel like any night of the week in the Bay, there can be, you know, 2 to 3 to 4 different things that you'll want to go do. And you have to kind of pick and choose. So it can be a harder market for bands to hit.
Yeah, I just didn't know what that meant because, I mean, obviously they've closed down a lot of, Slims is closed now and, AEG bought the Great American. So, you know, it's getting kind of chopped up in that way.
Yeah.
When I first moved up to San Francisco, there was so many different places you could play, even just in the Mission District. It was like there was 5 venues that you could play any given night. And there was like a lot more going on in terms of like a local scene, at least. Mm-hmm.
What was your favorite venue in the Bay that is gone now?
Oh, that's gone. Let's think about that. Actually, I think my favorite spots are still around. I mean, I used to love the Chameleon because it was kind of, it was so intimate and it was so close to my house. Mm-hmm. It was like a 200 capacity dive bar on Valencia Street at like 20th. Mm-hmm. And just everyone seemed to play there. It was always very friendly and fun and tiny. So just a sweat box, a really intimate kind of sweat box. I love that spot. I like Slims too.
What about that pole in the middle of the stage though?
that is a little bit weird. But I just saw a couple of their last shows. I think I saw Agent Orange there one night. I saw Dinosaur like right before before pandemic. And then obviously they just kind of didn't come back after pandemic. But like a lot of my favorite spots in San Francisco are still there. I love the Great American Music Hall so much. Love that room. The Regency was rad. Last night, and I just seen on why I'm just dropping band names that I've seen you guys to make it sound like
sure, it's fine.
I'm up on my shit, but, I mean, not having a job right now, I'm definitely, I have more time to go out and see music and I get hooked up a lot, you know, and my friends will come through town and just put me on the list. So I really have no excuse not to go to these things. And I want to, you know, throw my support and buy the shirt and all that stuff. But I love the Fillmore and Gilman. All great spots. And also the Kilowatt. Like I was talking about the Kilowatt, they just opened back up.
Yeah.
After not having live music for a million years. And Peter and Rick and Katie, these these kids opened it up and started doing music again. They put a great new sound system in there. It's fucking awesome over there. Love that
That's
spot.
Great.
And it's literally like across the street from my house. So I just walk over and see a band on any given night. It's great.
Yeah. That makes it nice. Especially that convenience.
Yeah. I think I was, I didn't used to go to this many shows, back in the day, but I think after that 2 year drought that we had of just being locked in, it must have kind of reawakened, you know, a love for going out and seeing bands live. I think I was maybe taking it for granted, and now I'm kind of catching up.
Yeah. Yeah. And also you touched on this briefly, but if you get put on the guest list,
yeah,
you gotta buy the t-shirt, right?
You gotta. You really should.
Yeah. Gotta buy some merch.
Yeah.
So tonight you're going to see Los Lobos tonight, right?
Yes, I'm gonna go see them tonight. Yeah, this has been a crazy week. I don't usually go to this many, but it just happened that I know some of these people from before, and I'm lucky. I'm lucky I get to go do this.
So you're friends with Alfredo Ortiz from that band?
Yeah, Fredo, totally.
So yeah, he's come up on the podcast a few times because he was in a ska band called Yes Ska back in the 90s.
Yes, totally.
And but you knew him, you met him when he was in Beastie Boys, right?
Yeah, he was playing with the Beastie Boys when we toured, and we did a tour with them and Sonic Youth and a bunch of and just a laundry list of every great 90s band. It was like Pavement and Beck and Rancid and Bikini Kill. Everybody was on the show.
This was a tour? What tour was this? Did it have a name?
Somersault. It was called Somersault in Australia, and it was in the winter of 95 to 90 into 96. So I guess their summer down there. Yeah, that was crazy. That was an insane tour. Yeah, so he was playing with them then. And I think I must have met him around sometime, just knocking around in L.A. But yeah, Fredo is an amazing musician, artist. He's an artist.
Nice.
So I get to see Fredo tonight. We're gonna go to we're gonna get dim sum before they play.
Nice.
Just dropping names over here, you know.
We're just dropping names. Just
it sounds pretty glamorous, doesn't it? Now that I'm talking out loud, it sounds pretty glamorous. But really, I'm just holed up in my rent controlled apartment watching Beverly Hills 90210 on any given night.
When you see Fredo, just drop the. Just tell me, talk to the ska guys today.
have you spoken to him like on the podcast?
Not yet. He's definitely on my list, but I tagged him in a post once and he shared it. So he's aware of us.
Yeah. That dude can play like he's ringing a bell, and he's been everywhere and he knows everybody. So he'd probably be a good talker.
Hell yeah.
This year, Jawbreaker was on tour and you guys took Joyce Manor with you.
Yes.
I want to ask about that. Cause, Barry Johnson, the singer, is a friend of the show. He was a ska kid growing up. So and we're friends with him, and obviously Jawbreaker was a huge influence on his band. So I'm curious what that was like to, you know, bring them on tour and what they were like.
They were great. They really went over, which of course they would, because they have a huge following. And we were lucky to get them. It was funny because I felt like right when the tour started, it was just, for some reason, it really felt very it was kind of crazy. It was felt like frying pan into the fire. Like we were just, boom, here you go. You're on tour now. So we didn't even really get a chance. Like, I think we spoke to them that first night and just kind of everyone kind of introduced each other and said hi. And then we were just off working. And the tour had a lot of really long drives. And sometimes we would fly to the next show because it was a two night overnight or something. And I don't know how those guys were getting around, but it was a pretty crazy, tour. But we, as it went along, obviously we got to have some more hang time and stuff with those guys. And then I ran into them, flying back at the end of the tour and got to hang out with them at the airport, which was probably the longest time that we were all just kind of sitting around chopping it up, just waiting for our flights. But yeah, those guys were great. I didn't know that he was a ska kid. But I mean, you know, I mean, we shouldn't be surprised, right? I mean, even like, I was thinking about the name of the podcast. I mean, like the very first thing that most anyone would probably bring up is like, does ska need defending? You know, like what, who's, I know that it was kind of a punchline for a while.
Yeah. Yeah.
In that, mm-hmm. kind of third or fourth wave, however you want to call it, like people would shit on it and scoff if you had horns in your band. But Ska's a big kid, can take care of themselves.
I think of a certain, if you came from a certain generation, you saw ska ascend into the mainstream and then plummet pretty hard and then sort of become viewed. I think part of the problem is that people sort of viewed ska in a very narrow lens for a while. Like if they were from that era, that's like, oh, mm-hmm. all ska is silly. All ska is from Orange County. You know, it's sort of like these things that are not true about ska. They're only true of like one variety of ska, when in fact, ska encompasses so much.
Yeah, it was. I mean, the same could be said for what people call emo, I guess, too, because that was huge for a while, and then that became the mm-hmm. the punching bag and the punchline or whatever. And then it kind of came back again, kind of came back around, which is kind of what it looks like is happening with ska now. People don't treat it like it's a guilty pleasure, but they're like, "Oh yeah, this is fun. I like to dance."
In Defense of Ska will return in a moment.
So when you guys came back, your first gig, well, your first main gig was Riot Fest in 2017 as the headliner.
Right.
But I know you did a few warm-up gigs before that, right? I know you played Ivy Room, which is in the East Bay.
Yeah, we did the Ivy Room for our old sound man's birthday party just to sort of warm up and see if we could play. And then we did Riot Fest, and then we came back and we played a bunch, like a series of smaller SF shows. Like we did Rickshaw and Bottom of the Hill and Great American. Just kind of hit our favorite spots. Bottom. I love Bottom too. I didn't mention Bottom. I love going down to Bottom.
Where does the Gilman show fit into there?
Oh, that might have been a bit later, because I think that we tried to get a show that first year back, but they were booked. I think there was a ska show that night, actually. and they felt bad because I think it was a band that was touring through and they didn't want to bump anybody, because we wanted to do it kind of last minute and not do a big, make a bit, like, you know, just kind of do a, announce it the day before and go play like a secret show, yeah. almost. And they couldn't accommodate it. So we just pushed it back. I think we ended up doing it in 2018, like the following year, I think. Mm-hmm.
Which show were you more nervous to play? Riot Fest or that very first show at the Ivy Room?
I think I'm pretty nervous before every show that we play. Mm-hmm. But there was certainly a different vibe, if I can use that word, doing Riot Fest, just because there were so many people and it was our first big, you know, whatever, coming out party. So that was kind of intense. Like I definitely took a long nap before we got on stage for that one. But I get freaked out just playing any show. I'm always trying to calm down. And that's why I sleep before we play.
How long do you need from when you sleep to when you get behind the drums?
Like a half an hour.
Oh, that's it?
Like, I mean, I don't, and I, it's a disco nap. Really, it's just like I just lay down and just try to close my eyes. And sometimes I'm not even sure if I get all the way out.
Right.
But I just try to, I don't know, just kind of, it's just kind of centering or something, relaxing. and get your heart beating slower. Yeah, just something I've always done. I did it back in the day too. I talked about this with somebody recently on a podcast, I think. Yeah, it's weird. And they were surprised. I think they were surprised. Like, you take a nap before every show? I was like, yeah, I do. It's like, it's my ritual. It's just how I cope with it. Cause I have a, you know, like all drummers, I have restless leg and a racing mind, I think.
Back when you guys were an active band, you guys didn't play anything as big as Riot Fest, did you?
No, never. That was a lot of people. We had never played even those festival shows that we did with the Beasties and Sonic Youth. We were the first band of the day, so there would just be a couple of thousand people. Eventually, by the time, you know, there might have been 30,000 people there when Beastie Boys take the stage, but we were just kind of playing to people that were filing in. And when we went and did that run with Nirvana in 93, we played a set of shows with them in the Midwest and Southwest. And those were like, I don't think those were, they weren't arenas. They weren't like stadiums. They were what they call, what do they call that? They were like sheds. They call them sheds, which is like bigger than a theater. But not quite like we might have done one hockey arena, but there weren't that many people, not nearly. No. But yeah, I think, you know, like, yeah, that Ivy Room show playing to like 50 of our friends was just as nerve wracking as playing to a bunch of people. Cause I have, you know, there's like that, an artist, who works on comic books once told me of that theory of, one too few, many. Do you know that?
No, what's this?
It's like the reason why they just give cartoon characters whatever four fingers, because there's, you know, there's one, you have two of something, and then you have three, a few, right? One, two, few, and then many. So after those first three, just it's like a lot. It's just too many to deal with. So I think of that, like looking out at, you know, a shitload of people. It's just kind of, it's almost like the uncanny valley or something. There's just like, when really, you know, playing on the floor in at a house party, right, with people right in front of you might be just as nerve wracking as a sea of humanity.
Yeah. Maybe even more nerve wracking because you can actually pick out individual faces.
Yeah, because they might be able to punch you right in the nose if they don't like it. They don't like what they're hearing. They just go and fall off and clock you.
It must have been a real trip though to return after so many years and you're the headlining act of Riot Fest. I mean, there's not a lot of band story where they have that happen to them, where they've gained that much momentum and that much popularity in the time that they're broken up.
Yeah, it was strange. It was surreal. And also, you know, sort of validating and, you know, vindicating or triumphant. There was definitely a feeling of, someone likened it to like, you know, your team, you know, your kind of underdog team winning the whole thing, winning the pennant or the World Series. Like it was very Rocky or something. It wasn't lost on us because, you know, when we would go play our you know, we were playing to maybe 1,000 or 2,000 people at the most, at our most popular, when we were a band. You know, just playing clubs. So that was insane. Then we all grow up 20 years and then turn out and play this massive thing. It was, you couldn't have written it or no one would have believed it, really. If you did write it, no one would have believed it. They would have been like, nah, it was insane.
Yeah. So back 30 years ago when you're at Fantasy Studios recording, Did you guys have any awareness at that time that you'd be creating something that would be so meaningful to people like 30 years later?
I think I did, and only because I had to have, like, I couldn't really, I have to operate thinking that there's consequences to the to working on something like that. Like,
yeah,
you have to have enough, and it's not, I wouldn't call it ego, because I didn't think that it would happen, but I think you have to go into it with that kind of intensity where you, like, you know, you're going to put something down. You want it, you want it to last. You want to think that what you're doing is going to be meaningful, at least to you, like maybe not to the yeah. whole world, but at least to you. So I thought that, I mean, I didn't think we were going to be the quote next Green Day, which is what obviously everyone was looking for at that time. But I knew that what we had done was going to be good and that I would be able to stand by it as an old man. I thought it was really good. And I think that's just a kind of result of having the audacity to want to try to be great. And I'm not saying we were great or are great, but you have to, if you're going to spend time doing something like this, like you better be in your favorite band and want to yeah. make it perfect and want to make it great. Otherwise you're just, you know, go be in a cover band or something.
For real.
So I don't know. Yeah. I think I just probably went into it with the audacity. Like I just had the audacity to think that what we were doing was going to matter in some way to some people. And the fact that it eventually did was cool, but honestly, I wasn't betting on it.
Yeah.
Was the reunion a product of several years of it trying to happen? How long were you guys all actively trying to make this happen?
Well, we weren't. And I think that worked on our, that worked for us. Like we weren't really trying, we weren't being aggressive about like, yeah, let's do this thing, come back and, you know, cash in or some shit like that. It was more like we were getting offers from, you know, we get like every year, like we hear from Coachella or some other kind of festival thing that, they'd ask us to do a reunion show or whatever. And I'd get that call and I'd call Blake and Chris, and Blake was doing Jets and Chris was doing, Mutoid Men or Shorebirds or whatever he was doing. And I was doing other stuff. And so it never really, it never was really a true consideration. And it was only way later that, you know, as our popularity grew, like our posthumous popularity grew, that like the, you know, they keep coming back and they'd be like offering us more and more money every year, and then we'd be like, nah. And all along, I'd have done it for less money, but Mike at Riot Fest finally called up and said, like, you know, he basically was like, look, we'll back up the truck for you and do whatever you want, and you can curate some of this festival with us and bring some bands that you like, and it just timed out that way. So Blake wasn't doing a band and Chris wasn't too busy and I was ready to do something, and we were all kind of in a weird place in our lives that it just seemed like the right thing to do. It was good because it gave us all something to look forward to, something to work on for a whole year or however long we took. It was just the serendipity, you know. But we weren't going out and trying to field offers, and we didn't have representation. We had no one speaking for us. It was trying to hustle and make this happen. It just happened kind of organically. And when we saw that it was going to be Riot Fest, that seemed like the perfect place to do it, because that's where, you know, the Replacements did it. And you know, we like that festival a lot.
Was it intention to keep playing after the festival, or did that come after you played?
I think that we were hoping that we could keep at it, but I think it was such a seemingly insurmountable thing that we were working towards that we really, that was like the, our eyes on the prize was just Riot Fest. Like, yeah. Let's just go through Riot Fest. And if we could survive that and not make total fucking fools out of ourselves, like, then maybe we continue doing this. Cause like we could have gotten up there and shit the bed, you know, we could have been terrible. It's not like shooting fish in a barrel, you know, just three people up on stage, like trying to make that big a noise. It's like, we might have not gone over. But I think we had a great show. It was super, you know, we definitely got tighter after Riot Fest with 2 years of touring. We were a pretty well-oiled machine. We were still a little bit raw at Riot Fest, but it had a different kind of energy just because of the, just because it was so intense, you know?
Yeah.
How much practicing did you guys do leading up to it?
I think we probably did like 9 months of practicing, but that's not me. That doesn't mean going in three times or four times a week for 5 hours or whatever, like we used to do when we were maniac 20-year-olds. Because we all live in three different cities, we would have to just kind of book, like every month we would book a week in San Francisco. And our friend Sean Biggs, who was working out of a studio in downtown, set us up. He totally set us up for success. I mean, like he had all of our equipment was in there and we had the time blocked out. We were in our own little world in this little studio, no lights, no visitors. Mm-hmm. So we did that like once a month for, I think, 9 months. We would go for a week at a time and play every day for as long as we could. We were pretty ready.
What did you guys do for food when you were locked down like that? Were you ordering out or did you guys go out to eat?
We'd go to, what's that burger place at the movie theater? We'd eat there a lot.
Burger place at the Metreon?
At the Metreon, yeah. It's on the inside, it's on the outside. It's a chain, it's like a local chain. I can't remember.
Is it the one that has those like that soft serve sign out front?
Yes.
Yeah, I can't think of what it's called though.
Yeah, we'd go in there, we'd get like we'd have food delivered, you know, when we wanted to eat well, we'd get some sensible salads in our bellies.
Super duper burger.
Super duper burger. That's it. Totally. Totally. No, we were getting like chicken sandwiches there and stuff.
Amazing.
But there's no shortage of food. This is San Francisco, man. Come on.
Hell yeah. What's the best spot to get a burrito in the Mission?
I would say Cancun. But they have the worst. They have the worst chips, though.
Oh yeah. How you feel about Pancho Villa?
I like El Toro, but I like their little sister store better. It's closer to me, and I think it's better.
Yeah.
Even though they have the exact same menu, I defy anyone to do an A/B taste test between Pancho Villa and El Toro.
Oh, the grill's gonna make a difference, though.
Yeah, they got their shit.
It's all about how the grill seasoned. And
yes, yes.
What's the worst taqueria in the Mission?
It's that no name one that is on the corner. I don't want to out anybody right now.
I think I know which one. The one by the BART station.
Shh.
No talking.
We don't want
about taquerias.
I don't want to start any shit, dude. I gotta fucking represent in my neighborhood, man. I don't want to.
You do. You do. I got to say, though, East Oakland's come up as far as burritos. I would take a burrito from East Oakland over the Mission burrito at this point.
Really? Okay.
Yep.
I'll fight. We can fight.
We can throw down.
Full disclosure, Adam lives in Alameda.
Yeah. So.
Okay. Love the flea market over there.
You know, I've never been.
Go there.
Yeah. I've lived here since 2010. No, 2009, and I've never gone to the flea market.
You're fucking up, man. You got to get there.
I fucked up bad. I got to go.
Get all sorts of stuff.
All right, so, Adam, are you familiar with the band Jawbreaker.
Of course.
Oh, yeah. Oh,
well, you're asking the other Adam.
No, I'm not asking yeah. you. I'm asking the other.
You know, I know who they are.
Yeah, totally. I have the 7-inch.
Hell yeah.
Yeah, that was such a great idea.
Yeah.
Do you know Brian Moss, the guy behind the project?
Yes. Yeah, that was genius. I thought, and I mean, you might want to explain. No one's going to know what we're talking about unless you really spell it out.
J-A-H Breaker.
Yeah.
It's Brian Moss's Reggae Jawbreaker tribute band.
Yes.
They put out a 7-inch on Silver Sprocket, and I think they played 2 or 3 shows.
Yeah, they made shirts and everything.
Yep. I had a shirt for a while. I don't know what happened to it.
Pretty great. And what was it? And it was all like puns. Like they would do covers, reggae style, but kind of switch the words around to be about smoking dope and stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then I think like, then they did a release where it was very San Francisco location focused too. Because it was very, very weird, like in joke, I think.
Well, I mean, I think that those shows did pretty good. Like I remember that it was kind of, they kind of made a splash. Like people were into it.
Yeah.
I mean, what's the lowest run you could do for making a 7-inch? Like probably like 200 or something.
I think they did more than that though.
I mean, there might've been 500 people that were in on that joke. That's a lot of people to be on an inside joke.
Yeah.
I found an interview that Brian did about the project on Vice, and he said that one of the main motivating factors for us was the awareness of how uptight and nearly religious some Jawbreaker fans are.
Yeah, sure.
And he's a Jawbreaker fan. So he's poking fun at his own people.
I like to think that our people are have a sense of humor. I think most people, I mean, when I posted about it on our socials, people were loving it. And like that Jawbreaker reunion band, people love that shit. Mm-hmm. Like, what a funny idea to call your band Jawbreaker Reunion.
I'm not familiar with that one.
Yeah, yeah.
They just called their band Jawbreaker Reunion?
Yeah, so that's what it said on the flyer. And then, you know, maybe a couple people would show up and be like, what? This isn't, you know. Great idea, right?
That's genius.
Yeah, we thought about, I can't remember where we were thinking about someone was talking about doing a secret show with them, but actually playing before them.
Oh man.
Be pretty great. You know?
Yeah.
Okay. So speaking of Silver Sprocket, I want to talk a little bit about the event that I met you at, where Dan Ozzie was reading.
I bought your book that night, by the way, right? Didn't I buy it? Or did you give it to
me? No, you paid me. You handed me a $20 bill. It was very nice of you.
I did, didn't I?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
But the funny thing that happened was while Dan was talking, you came in and he didn't know you were there.
Right. Well, I don't really know. I don't know Dan. He sent me a couple of books to give to the guys, the book that he wrote, Sellout, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And then I heard that he was going to be in town. I was like, oh, I'll go check that out. It wasn't like I didn't mean it for it to be such a like a gotcha thing, you know.
But the funny thing is he talked at length about what an important band Jawbreaker were for him, and I think he felt like a little kind of embarrassed, a little like, oh my god, I didn't know there was a member of Jawbreaker in the audience while I was saying all this stuff.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I'll admit it. I did get a little bit uncomfortable. When he was being so effusive. Is that the right word?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I was just kind of chilling. I come in. Another thing is I came in late, like an asshole. I came in late and everyone was sitting down already. So I ended up kind of just milling around the stacks, looking at comic books and listening to what he was saying because there were no more chairs. But I appreciated that. That was cool. I was like tickled to hear him tell stories and talk about it. And then we met afterwards. It was funny.
Mm-hmm.
And it turns out we had people in common too. So it was, you know, small world.
Yeah. Punk rock's a small town, right?
Yeah, definitely.
Yes, totally. Totally. But yeah, then we got you showed me your book and we got to talking about this, and I'm sorry it's taken this long for me to get my shit together, but I've had my head kind of up my own ass for the last hour or long trying to work on these tours and stuff.
Oh no, that's fine.
it's cool. It's cool. We got to do this, but it made me kind of rack my brain about my sordid ska past. And I was thinking about it and just kind of going through my records and stuff. Another thing that made me think of was like, I don't know how you guys have your, I just have all of my records alphabetically. Like I don't have them chopped up into the genres or anything like that, or kinds of music. How do you guys do it?
Here's what I do. I have two of those, eight slot, IKEA shelves that fit records.
Yes.
I have two of those in my studio, and the top two right underneath the record player, right-hand side is what I'm currently listening to.
Yes.
That is like chill music. Left-hand side is what I'm currently listening to that is heavier, faster music, and everything else is just a mess.
Okay, so you don't have them all. You don't have them all like kind of. I have them diced up like. Well, and how about you?
I don't have a record vinyl collection anymore. I'm like strictly digital, but when I did have a vinyl collection, it was alphabetical. I didn't divide them up in any other way, just alphabetical, just because I just want to be able to find what I want to find.
Did you get rid of all your records in one lot? Did you give them away or sell them to one person?
I owed a friend some money, and so I gave him my record collection to make it so we were square.
Wow. How many records was that?
It was a lot.
Yeah, was there remorse giving those away? Were you gutted or were you okay with it?
No, because I actually like, I kind of have transitioned to, I just sort of like owning MP3s. I know I'm not quite into Spotify, but I kind of like owning MP3s and having a big database on my computer of all my music.
Right.
It's kind of a weird thing because I know a lot of musicians are very sentimental about the physical record. And I don't necessarily feel that, although I do like, you know, records are cool because they're works of art. But I can kind of do that with MP3s. I think I'm an anomaly a little bit.
Does it not fuck with the way you listen to records though? Because I find that like I have this big blank spot in my collection that's CDs, right? Like the years that I started buying CDs, which was, I don't know when that was. When would that have been? Like the early 90s to like 2000 or something. Like there's a big gap where I wasn't buying records. And now that I don't have a CD player in my car that used to have a CD player is gone. CDs are useless. So all the CDs are like in my basement now. Those are all available digitally. And of course I have Spotify and all that shit, but the way I listen to music now is so passive that, and with everything at my fingertips, with the history of music at my fingertips, I find myself listening to the same fucking 14 songs every single day. Do you not have that problem?
No, because I kind of have a very complicated and most likely has to do with OCD system of how I listen to music.
Okay. So,
and it involves lists. It's very, very neurotic, but it does make me listen to all kinds
of your compulsion. Your OCD is making you is necessarily okay. It's okay for digital consumption.
Yes,
it works. It works for digital stuff.
It works. Yeah.
maybe even better because it's quicker. You don't have to get up and flip the record and stuff.
Yeah.
I still have all my records and they're here. There's the stuff I'm listening to is in the cabinet underneath where the record player is. Everything else is over in this big shelf on my wall. And those are just done like there's just 12 inches alphabetically. There's 10 inches alphabetically and 7 inches alphabetically. So I don't have anything chopped up by genre. It's like whatever. So I was just looking through all of my records and I just dug out like when I DJ and stuff, like I always play the Ghost Town 12 inch always like the last song of the night is Ghost Town. But then I seem to be missing a lot of stuff actually is what I found.
What are you missing?
I'm missing a couple of Specials records and I don't know. I think my kids probably stole them because my kids went through my stack and kind of robbed a bunch of stuff that they were getting into. And, you know, what's mine is theirs anyway. I just hope that they turn up. But like I have like not one David Bowie record anymore. My kids have all the David Bowie records.
I think I had every single 70s Bowie record when I had a collection.
Yeah, you can't not, right?
Yeah.
I think that, God, probably, but Bowie was probably one of the very first records I ever bought with my own money, I think.
Oh, yeah? Which record?
I think it was Pinups, the covers record.
Yeah, what a weird record to dive in on Bowie with.
Oh, no, you know what? No, that was my dad's. My dad's cool. My dad had a great record collection, which probably explains my kind of broad musical taste, because he had all the, you know, he had Bowie, but he also had all the Beatles and Stones records, and he had weird records, like, you know, he had Mothers of Invention records and Elvis records and Miles Davis and John Coltrane. So it's like, that's how I came up. I think I stole pinups from him, and that's how I learned how to play drums. I learned how to play drums basically with pinups and like Clash and Go-Go's records. I lost track of what I was saying. I can't remember. Maybe it might have been Scary Monsters. Maybe. Does that make sense? No, it might be a little bit later. That might be a little bit later. Yeah, a lot of records that I came up with, I got handed down to me by my older sister, and then I stole from my dad's record collection. So like Talking Heads and all the punk stuff and X and all that stuff, my sister kind of bequeathed to me. And then the kind of classic rock and jazz and stuff I got from my dad.
What does your sister do now?
My sister's an artist. My sister is a singer in a band and like a fashion designer and a fine artist and a performance artist. She's
sick.
She's called Kembra Fowler. You can look her up. Kembra Fowler. She's in a band called The Voluptuous Horror of Karen Black. They've been playing in New York since the late 80s or early 90s, kind of a glam punk band. Mm-hmm. But she has like it's kind of hard to pigeonhole like what exactly it is that she does, because she does so many different kind of things. Like she has a collaboration right now of some clothing designs that she did with Rick Owens. And she's had, you know, her fine art in at the Whitney, you know, she had a Whitney Biennial. And so she's kind of a, you know, she's like my cool older sister, artist, musician lady.
That's really cool. Cause I mean, usually you hear about, you know, older siblings passing down music to you, and then you'll ask, oh, what happened to your sibling? And they're like, oh, they don't really like music anymore.
They got a straight job.
Yeah, they got a straight job. It's cool to hear that your sister like went for it.
No, my sister went for it in the biggest way. Like my sister's like a true artist. Like that's how she makes her living. She's an artist, and it's feast or famine. You know, like it's like either she's doing great or it's like she's struggling like everybody else. But she's been in it forever, and she's not getting out anytime soon. So she's definitely the real deal.
Lifer.
Yeah.
And your dad was a professional surfer, right?
My dad, well, I have, when I say my dad, like when I speak about my dad, I'm either talking about my birth father. Is that how you say that? My
sure.
Biological father.
That's what I meant. Biological father. My surfer. And then my stepdad, who's been around since I was like 7 years old. He's just like a philosopher. he had the great record collection, but my biological father, Fred, he was one of those original South Bay surfers from the 50s. You know, he surfed with Lance Carson and God, everybody, Dewey Weber. He was in Bruce Brown movies before the movies that he made right before Endless Summer. So my dad's in Slippery When Wet.
We'll be right back after this.
Going back to Jawbreaker, you've kind of been the band's archivist, haven't you?
Yeah.
Is that something you were doing during the run, or is that sort of something you took on after the band broke up?
I always just kind of ended up with the stuff. I had the tapes. I had the 2-inch tapes and the mixed down master tapes, and I ended up just kind of saving our posters and flyers just for my personal collection, just for, you know. And I kept a journal, and, you know, I'd steal a camera out on tour and take pictures. And I kept all those. So yeah, I guess it was just sort of something I did. I wasn't really thinking about it. I certainly wasn't thinking about it. I didn't have the foresight to like save all my negatives and to box everything up perfectly and to catalog things. I wasn't that kind of archivist. I was more just like, wow, this will be cool to have someday. And I just sort of take pictures and roll up the posters and throw them into my basement. That's just kind of who I was. But it turns out, I guess that's called being an archivist. Like, I didn't know that was really a thing, but that's what I've been called that before, and I'll take it. Cause I think that's exactly what I've been doing. Again, with no real end goal, but thinking somewhere in the back of my mind that maybe someone would give two shits about this stuff at some point. And yeah, had the audacity to think that. And then it turns out that came in handy, because people started asking around. And wrote a book or made a movie about it. So I'm glad I held on to all that shit.
And that really came in handy when the documentary was made, right?
Yeah, I mean, that everything that turns up in there that's not a brand new talking head interview is really probably from archive, my pile of shit that I kept.
Is there anything that you archived that you lost that you can't find now?
Is there anything that's lost?
Like, I have a very specific picture in my collection of stuff.
Oh, just in your mind, and you know it's somewhere.
And I know it existed. It was a Polaroid.
Yeah.
And I no longer have it. Is there anything like that for you?
I probably do, but there was so much stuff that I think I just forgot. There's nothing that I'm really wondering, oh yeah, where is that fucking thing? I have, it's pretty much all there in our storage space or in my closet, really.
That's great.
But there was a time that I kind of stopped like saving the flyers, which I'm kind of bummed about. Like, when we first started out, like our first national tour, I saved every little thing, every little ticket stub and flyer and handbill and photograph. And then when it became like how we made our living and we were out so much, I kind of slowed down with that. So I wouldn't have photo. Like, I don't think I have one photo from our run with Nirvana. You would think that I would have been happy to shoot all that stuff. But I didn't. I probably just wanted to not feel like, you know, I probably was just trying to play it cool and act like we belong there or something. I wasn't like trying to get a picture with it. Like, you know, this is back before we had cameras in our phone. This is when you'd have to go out and get a throwaway camera or point and shoot or something, and then get the shit developed 3 weeks later. But yeah, no, it's pretty complete. It's pretty complete. And a lot of the stuff didn't end up in the movie. And, you know, I've someone asked if I wanted to do like a coffee table book or something with all of my personal photographs and just like all of the archive that I've saved. But I think I like the idea of doing that, but I don't want to do it until we're definitely like not a band anymore. That's something I think that should be done like as a epilogue or something after the things all run its course. Mm-hmm.
So, okay, so the roots of Jawbreaker start in like the 80s in New York, and you move to LA, but it takes a little while to sort of get the lineup that you guys are, the three-piece lineup.
Yeah.
I read a story that you had a guy named John Liu that sing for you, and you realized Blake was going to be the singer. So you made your bass player kick him out?
Chris. Yeah. John sang for us for a good while. John sang in a band called Magnolia Thunder Pussy in the 80s. And they got signed to SST Records, but I think that, I don't know, one of their guys, they went off to school or something, and they didn't end up following through. They ended up breaking up, but they were a great band that we used to go see, and that me and Blake used to go, you know, we were in a band called Red Harvest in high school, and we would play with them. So John was someone that we knew from way back when. So we started playing with Chris, and we got John to sing. First, we had a singer in New York called Ray Lugo, who was this hardcore kid from the Lower East Side that we met. Ray's still at it actually right now. He's got a great band that tours all over the world. Then we got John in there, and I think we had booked a show and John missed the show. Like he just didn't show up or something. And he was doing school. He was in school trying to finish up getting his degree. And I just think that it was, we wrote a song with that Blake sang, and it seemed like it would be okay if he took over those duties. So we, you know, terrified because John's our friend, we didn't know how to deal with telling him this. And Chris ended up breaking the news, and it was ugly and it was shitty. But now we're all friends again. And John was my drum tech at Riot Fest and remains one of my closer friends to this day.
Nice.
Oh yeah, we were scrambling. We didn't know exactly what we were doing. We started out as an instrumental band, and then we were kind of trying singers, and it just it wasn't really clicking. And the only time it really clicked was when we just stopped and just like, how about just the three of us and just let Blake try it out. And it was clear that he was such a good writer, that it just made sense to do it that way.
So you did, you toured with Econochrist in 1990.
Mm-hmm.
It was called the Fuck 90 Tour.
Yeah.
So you're still in LA at this point. How did you connect with them? Did they play down there with you or something? Or did you come up to the Bay and play?
I'm not sure if we played with Econochrist before that tour, but we certainly met.
Oh, really?
I could look it up right now. I have all our shows written down, but off the top, maybe we did. Maybe we did. Maybe we played Gilman with them or something on one of our many trips up the coast. We do that trip a lot. When we were kind of based in LA for a while, we would drive up a lot and play Gilman and Covered Wagon and Marsugis and San Jose and maybe get up to Chico or whatever. But yeah, I mean, Blake booked that first tour in 1990, where we did like 50 something shows in as many days. It was like a crazy tour. We a lot just played every single day, sometimes twice a day. Like we do an in-store and then go play that night. But we did a good long run with Econochrist on a tour and became tight with them. And it was, you know, it might have seemed incongruous because Econochrist is like a blistering hardcore band, and we were a little poppier than that, you know. We were like not like an indie rock band, but just not, you know, just whatever it is, whatever the fuck it is that we do. I don't know what you call it. I guess they called it emo later, but whatever it was. But you know, we got along with those guys, and they were cool, and they were. They were part of that. They were like ex Little Rockers from Arkansas. And that's a great scene that's always been really supportive of our band. Like, we always made a stop over in Little Rock. So we got tight with those guys, and we just kept on, and we played a bunch with them. Great band.
I've heard it said that a lot of the shows weren't great on that tour, and it was just overall rough.
Yeah. Well, that's, you know, it was our first tour. So of course, sometimes you show up and there'd be like four people there, or else you're just playing to, you know, the other band, or there's a bunch of fucking skinheads there, or whatever it is, whatever, you know, we were just paying dues. Like, we were having the time of our lives, or is it the times of our life? However you say that. So yeah, it was like, you know, it was amazing just being in a van and eating at dinner at Circle K at 4 a.m. Just all that stuff was romantic and fun, and it was just a big adventure. So it wasn't as grueling as all that. We were just, you know, when you're in your early 20s, like, you don't give a shit. You're just out there having fun. Mm-hmm. So I don't actually look back at that and go like, oh man, we really had it rough. Like, oh, but woe is me. We had to read books in the van and not look at our phones. Like, you know what I mean? Like, it was like, to me, it was like a total adventure. We were like, you know, driving in the middle of the night and looking, you know, looking for UFOs or whatever it was that we were doing, you know, just like we were, it was fun. So it was rough, but like, you have to do, every band has to have a tour like that.
Yeah.
We were just out. Grumpster was just opening for us on those Joyce Manor shows, and Grumpster is a great band from the East Bay. And those guys were like, you know, they had the whole thing. Like, they, you know, their van broke down and they had to rent a U-Haul, and someone got sick one night, and I'm like, oh man, you guys are, that's fucking rough. How are you guys dealing? And they were like, what? This is a gas. We're having a great time.
Yeah. Things are different when you're younger. Yeah. Doing this kind of stuff.
Yeah. I mean, if we had a tour, like our first tour right now, that would be rough. That would be, you know, that would be a tragedy. It would have been sad. It would have felt bad for these 50 something year old dudes. You'd be like, oh man, sorry. But you know, when you're 22 or whatever, it's like, yeah, go drill them, get out there.
So can you kind of explain what leads up to you relocating to San Francisco?
San Francisco is always just one of those places that, you know, they kind of welcomed us with open arms and they booked us. It was hard to get a show down in LA. And we found, you know, the Gilman people were very supportive. We made friends up here, made friends with Lance Hahn from J Church and Cringer, made friends with the Sam I Am guys, and ended up doing a bunch of shows with them. And, you know, coming from LA, me and Blake coming from LA, you know, San Francisco is just right up the street, 400 and something miles. It didn't seem like that big a deal to move up here. But yeah, it just seemed like an easier place to live, cheaper place to live. And there was clubs that we knew were going to book us, and labels up here that we thought we could count on to put our records out. Like, and that became those guys at Revolver, Tupelo, and Communion Records, and Shredder Records, and all those people were super supportive early on. And we weren't really getting that kind of response down. It was hard for us to book shows in LA. Sometimes they'd try to make you pay to play. And, you know, when we were trying to get back at it, it was like, it was tough because it was all that kind of Sunset Strip. Kind of new that third wave glam metal that came through. So there wasn't a whole lot going on until, you know, Anti-Club and Raji's and those kind of places started. And when Jabberjaw came back around in the early, when they opened up in the early 90s, it became a little bit easier for like an underground or a punk band or some weird band to have a place to play. But yeah, LA being mine and Blake's home was, you know, we certainly by the time we moved to San Francisco, we would go down every chance we could to play down there. So it remained kind of like our home in a way.
Did you feel like a full-fledged part of the Gilman scene, or did you feel like you were sort of part of it, but you were sort of part of something else during this time period?
Well, we were, you know, and I've said this before, we felt a little bit like interlopers up here. Like, we came up like in the wake of Op Ivy, and Green Day, and I think we moved here in 91.
Yeah, so Operation Ivy is already broken up at that point.
Yeah, and Green Day's just taken off. And we, you know, we of course we knew Green Day because we had the Lookout records, and we had the unfortunate experience of having to follow those guys on tour and hear from the promoter, "Oh yeah, Green Day was here last week. You should have seen. There was 500 people here then, but yeah, sorry about that, man." But when we came up to SF, like, we, you know, like, yes, they we were welcomed with open arms, but we never really felt totally part of the Gilman scene because we weren't there at its formation and never worked the door there. And we also didn't really feel totally at home with all of that Boner Records and Revolver distribution scene, which was maybe a little bit older. I was just listening to Blake talk about this, maybe it's on that Shred with Shifty podcast. We all agree that we didn't really seem to fit into any real scene up here. We did feel like kind of like we came late to a game or something.
What about the Maximum Rock and Roll scene, or, you know, for, you know, obviously prior to Dear You, how did you feel about Maximum Rock and Roll and those people?
Well, a lot of those people, we knew from the neighborhood, and they were our friends, and they were also some of those people were the people that were, you know, hardest on us and most critical of us when we signed to a major label, mm-hmm. Including Tim and all the, you know, all those people. But you know, they were sticking to their guns, and we respected that, but we just didn't give a shit about that for us. We were just ready to try something else and kind of move on. And, you know, unfortunately, back in the day, people looked at that as like, oh, you're turning back, you're back on this scene that kind of made you what you are. But we didn't really think of it that way.
In Defense of Ska will return in a moment.
I want to talk about the Nirvana tour a little bit. I have some very specific details I read about. I want to ask you.
Okay. Where did you read it?
The internet.
Okay. So, well, you know, it's true then. If you read it on the internet, it's probably true. I guarantee you everything is totally true.
Okay. Well, I don't need to ask them. No. So Kurt heard about you from his nanny, Callie.
Mm-hmm. Callie. Yeah. Callie. True. True.
She was a big fan and would play your music. And then you kind of was like, what's that?
Callie is a dude.
Oh, I'm sorry.
It's okay. Identifies as a man, as far as I know. He's a great artist. Callie DeWitt, DeWitt. He does cool visual art. You could look him up. A fine artist, and actually was designed a lot of merch for Kanye before Kanye flew off the rails. Mm-hmm. So Callie was Kurt and Courtney's nanny, and I guess introduced Kurt to our stuff. And the Wipers were supposed to open those shows, and something happened. And the Wipers had to drop out, so at the last minute, they invited us to fill in. and which we were happy to do. And that was sort of the beginning of the kind of, oh, these guys are sellouts thing, because we went on tour with Nirvana. That was a no-no.
Yeah, that is such a weird part of the story, because just accepting a tour offer by Nirvana, who are, yeah, they're huge, but they're a good band.
Great band.
Like, that somehow equals like selling out. It's such a strange time.
Yeah, we didn't agree with that clearly, or else we wouldn't have done it. So we were like, okay, say what you will, we're going on tour with the fucking greatest band on the planet. Go fuck yourself.
Yeah.
And that wasn't taken kindly in some circles, and that's okay. You can't please everybody, you know. Like, we're not for everybody. Yeah, we're inviting. You're inviting you to be part of this thing, and you can do. You can take it or leave it. That's okay. If you're not down.
So I think it was the Chicago shows. Bob Goldthwait was there.
Yeah, Bobcat.
Bobcat was there, and he introduced Mudhoney and Nirvana before their sets. And you guys asked if he'd introduce you, and he said, no, because I don't really know who you are.
Yeah. Right. You know what's funny about that is that Bobcat used to drop in. Like, I had a video store on Valencia Street up here called Lost Weekend, and we were there for from 97 to 2017. So we were there 20 years, and we opened up a comedy club in our basement, and we had a bar down there. It was basically a speakeasy. That we built, and so we started doing comedy down there, and like big comics would like show up and do sets just for fun. Like Kamau Bell used to come and drop in, and Natasha Leggero did a whole week there, I think, before she went on tour, and Maria Bamford came, and Bobcat would come and do sets, and I almost brought that up to him, but I didn't. I had every opportunity to be like, dude, fuck you for not introducing us at those Nirvana shows. But I didn't even tell him who I was. I was just like, thanks for doing a set in our little dingy, windowless fire trap of a basement. Thanks, dude. But it was okay, though, because at those Chicago shows, we just had Ben Weasel come out and introduce us. And of course, he pissed everybody off. Because he has a knack for that.
Well, if Bobcat ever comes on this podcast, I promise you, I will ask him. I will bring up him refusing to introduce Jawbreaker.
Bobcat Goldthwait, big ska fan. I'm gonna bet that he is. I'm gonna bet that he is.
You think?
I mean, who? I just want to know who it is that likes music that can't get behind like Madness and the Specials or like, you know, bands on Trojan Records. You know, like who is that?
Yeah, not Bobcat. Yeah,
I really do feel like there's something for everybody.
Come on. Oh, that's another thing I was remembering. Oh my God, I saw Madness with the Go-Go's in like 1983. That was fun.
Oh, you did? What was that? Was that the Roxy or?
No, it was like a huge, stadium show. It was like, it was on, I can't remember if it was the Sirius Moonlight. It was a Bowie tour.
Wait, they opened for Bowie?
It was like Bowie, Go-Go's, and Madness in like Anaheim, I think. I think it was it wasn't where the baseball team played. It was like some other place. It was like, but it was a stadium show. It was crazy. I'm pretty sure that's what it was. You can look it up.
I'll look it up.
I could be totally wrong, actually.
Okay, one more Nirvana question. Okay, now...
No, go ahead.
You and Kurt swapped band shirts at the end of the tour?
Yes. True. True story.
And so you still have your Nirvana shirt, right?
Yeah, totally. Or maybe my kids... one of my kids might have it.
And... Kurt's Jawbreaker shirt is on is in the Sunset Boulevard Guitar Center window or something, right?
It was for a while. I think that they switched that up, and they might have wiped it clean and put a bunch of new stuff in there. I don't know why they would take Kurt's stuff out of there, but That's where it was the last time I checked. It was in the window, like at the San Francisco or the Sunset Boulevard Guitar Center in Hollywood. It's right near the Denny's there where Rodney Bingenheimer eats. They have like, it's kind of like Grauman's Chinese Theater. There's like dudes' hands in cement and stuff, I think, I want to say, on the sidewalk out front. And then they have like a window, a little like a little window of just rock and roll memorabilia and stuff. Yeah, that's where that Kurt's Jawbreaker shirt lived for a really long time. And I heard that the guy that gave him that, I don't know how he got a hold of it, but I heard that he got a shitload of dough, or maybe free gear. Free recording equipment from Guitar Center.
Oh.
I would have liked to have had that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah, I guess I'll have my In Utero shirt somewhere knocking around. In my huge pile of shit in my basement, probably.
In your archives.
Well, somewhere down there, you've also probably got the ticket stub for your David Bowie show, September 9th, 1983.
That, I don't know. I was for sure there.
With Madness and the Go-Go's.
Did you look it up?
Yeah.
So that happened.
Anaheim Stadium.
I'm just trying to get some fucking cred, you guys. I just need some cred.
Just need that ska cred.
I need some ska cred. I do.
He saw Madness in 1983. He's got more cred than me.
Yeah, that's all he needs. Do you remember Jawbreaker ever playing with any ska bands?
Gosh, we must have. I'm trying to think. Like that I don't know how you break it up. Like, what do you call, like, do you call like Less Than Jake? Is that third wave?
Yeah, they'd be third wave.
Is that a third wave band? Because I remember there was a grip of bands coming out of Gainesville that were doing ska besides them?
I can't think of any others besides them that were doing ska.
I thought there was more. You were saying that there was that third wave thing was happening a lot down in where?
Oh, Southern California.
But like down in
Orange County.
Right, in OC. Okay, right, yeah. Right. Who are some of those bands that you think about?
Say Ferris.
Real Big Fish.
Oh, right.
Those are the big ones.
Well, it's funny because last night I was at the Linda Linda show and I was talking, and of course Carlos played drums for Real Big Fish. He's the father of two of the kids in the Linda Lindas.
Oh
yeah. Carlos, I think started and I think he joined Real Big Fish in like 2000, 2001. I know Cheer Up was the first record he played on.
Yes. So I'm always needling him about the resurgence of ska and how he better get his chops ready to come back.
Yeah.
Thank you for your service.
I could see it happening, but I off the top of my head, no, I don't think so. And we never played with Op Ivy, because they had just broken up when we started coming up here.
What about Dancehall Crashers?
Oh, maybe we did play with Dancehall Crashers. I think we did.
Yeah,
probably. I'm sorry. I'm a little bit sketchy on my.
Sure, it was wild.
Like being an archivist and having everything written down, it also gives you like all this license to be completely lazy and using your brain because it's just all there in the machine or in the basement, so I could just go refer to it very handily. But like, is it in my brain? Not all the time. So I was trying to rag, you know, knowing how we were going to do this today, I was like, what do I got? What ska do I got? Like, what? But turns out we're not really talking. We're just talking about everything but. That's fine. It's fine too. Did I play alto sax for a while? Yes, I did.
Oh yeah.
Is that ska
cred? Oh, you did.
Do I have ska cred now?
Was that in high school?
It was after. It was right during the band, like right when the band got together.
That was when he was in that ska band on the side.
Wanted to play the riff from Baker Street, I think. No, but I played for a while. It wasn't very good. One of my kids also plays alto sax, actually. And keyboard. So yeah, that's another thing. And furthermore, Like, what's the problem with horns? Like, what's the big deal about horns? Like, well, you can't have horns in the song. Go fuck you. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, who said that? Like, what happened in the 90s where people like, no, that's not cool anymore?
You know, here's the thing. And I feel like this might be somewhat of a U.S. thing. Horns are really cool, but for some reason, a lot of people think they're not in the U.S. are not cool at all. But, like, I don't know that other countries have that attitude towards horns.
That hang up.
Yeah.
You know who kind of brought them back? You know who kind of brought them back and made them cool again? Rocket.
Oh, yeah. Rocket from the Crypt. Totally.
Yeah, I never saw anything wrong with it. I'm just looking for that ska crowd, guys.
Yeah, here's a little here's a possible ska connection. We're going to confirm this. Dear You. Now, I read that you guys recorded Dear You in the same studio at the same time as Rancid recorded And Out Come the Wolves.
Yes, we were right next door to each other. That's true. I feel like I'm answering these. I feel like I'm answering these questions like I'm in a like I'm in a little cross exam room. Like,
yeah, true or false?
Right. There's like a naked light bulb hanging over my head, and you've like deprived me of food and coffee. And
yeah, you're doing fine so far. So far.
One of you guys is the good cop, and one of you guys is the bad cop.
Oh, I'm good cop.
Yeah, those guys were in there making that legendary record, and it was funny because Blake would just tell us a story on that Shifty episode too, that like at one point we went in and listened to their mixes, and they came and listened to ours, and Blake was like, "Oh shit, we're in trouble." Because he could just hear it. He was like, yep, that's the one that's gonna sell, that's gonna move units. I'm not quite sure what's gonna happen with ours. And sure enough, they threw ours up against the wall and it did not stick.
Dear You has found a lot of love since then.
Oh yeah, no, for sure. Yeah. But people shit on it immediately when it came out, so
yeah.
But yeah, that was fun. And yeah, and there was, you know, it's Fantasy Studios is such a legendary place that they're, you know, everyone recorded there. And you know, like Booker T was like walking around like in a bathrobe in the hallways, like just drinking coffee and stuff. It was cool.
Well, and then you were saying that you have the reels, I'm guessing, from those sessions. Did you get those at the time, or did you get those when Fantasy shut down?
No, those are the only the only tapes I don't have are from Dear You, because there's so many of them. And because you're on the major at that point, the reels were safe and sound in a very secure warehouse, I believe, down at the Universal lot in Los Angeles, until they burned up in a giant fire and are now completely lost to history.
Damn.
But the beauty is that when they were making the documentary about Jawbreaker, I thought it would be smart to get instrumental mixes of our stuff that they could, so they could use that as like incidental soundtrack.
Yeah.
So I worked it out with Universal Music that they would digitize our masters and send us you know, a hard drive of that, so I could pull that, those songs. And so I actually have our masters on a hard drive.
Oh, hell yeah.
So that was just dumb luck, because a couple years later the place went up in smoke and all this incredible music just like evaporated, which is incinerated, I should say.
Yeah, I remember that happening.
I just want to go back to this Outcome the Wolves, because there was one interview, I think it was Blake, who said that you guys are recording Dear You, and there's sadness in the record. It's just you guys. There's, you know, you're kind of in your own little bubble.
Yes.
You go over to see Rancid and there's like 20 friends there, and it's just a party. Like, it's just night and day vibe, right?
Yeah. Like, if there were chandeliers in there, people would be swinging from that shit. It was, they were having a ball. They're having a great time, just tearing it up. and our shit was all like fucking dark and morose, like candle lit.
Do you guys actually have candles lit?
I doubt it. But, but I think I'll lie and say that we did. Yeah.
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 Sure. It sounds better that way. Yeah, totally. Yeah, sure. It was candle lit. It was pretty fucking gnarly. There was some incense burning. Like Blake was sipping Courvoisier and just smoking Pall Mall and filtered cigarettes and drinking straight black coffee until the wee hours of the night. It was fucking grim, man. No, I mean, it was, ours was just, you know, it was more solitary because there's only, number one, there's only three of us. And then really we just had a producer and an engineer, and sometimes the drum doctor would be in there tuning drums. Mm-hmm. And so at the most, there were six people in our session, and that was only for 3 days. And then the rest of it was Blake and the engineer and the producer. It was just those three guys in there for a couple of weeks working on guitar overdubs and vocals.
Yeah.
So yeah, different scene, you know?
So the reissue for Dear You happened in 2004, and you were kind of the main person negotiating that deal, right? Because you had the license or the master or something, right?
Well, I had to pay them, but yeah, I did that. I got all our records back from our indie labels, and I got the okay from any labels that put out split 7-inches or put us out on their compilation tracks. I got the okay and the master tapes back from them as well to put out a compilation of all our B-sides and rarities and stuff and comp tracks. Mm. And I put out all of, I remastered and put out all of our LPs as well. And the only one I couldn't get buyback outright was Dear You. 'Cause I was told that, you know, the Universal Music isn't in the business of, you know, selling masters back, giving masters back. So I had to license it from them, meaning I had to pay them. I think I had to pay them $10,000 and then give them a percentage of every unit that was sold starting from the first one. So I did that. And I think I got a five-year license from them. And yeah, so I sold that one for 5 years, and it was a pain in the ass to get it, but yeah, that was my work. But I was happy to do it because I wanted that record to become available because I saw that it was being sold online for like a lot of money and that people were, you know, either bootlegging it or, you know, paying crazy amounts of money for the original pressings. They only did one pressing of Dear You. And then when it didn't sell, they just kind of gave up on us and just bailed. So you could find them in the cutout bins, or you can find them on CD for super cheap. But yeah, they just kind of bailed on us. And before streaming became a thing, they were more open to licensing it to me to put out the physical copy of it, which I was grateful for because then I could, you know, be real completist about it and get it into the hands of people that wanted it for cheap, you know, for a normal price point, as they say. Because I knew it wasn't lost on me that people were kind of learning about us again and you know, other bands were kind of like name checking us. Like new groups were coming up that were real super popular that would be like, oh yeah, loved Dear You, and they kind of breathe new life into that record, which helped a great deal, and things like YouTube, and I'm sure what was that first Napster, like all that stuff, shitty as it was, kind of kept that record alive for a while, while the label had let it languish into obscurity. But yeah, I got that back and put it out for 5 years and then lost that license. And now I think Universal is pressing it again. Hmm. That was the longest answer of this entire when I could have just said, yep.
Oh, but that yep's not a good answer.
That was the answer we wanted, though.
Okay. But yeah, it was a pain in the ass. It was hard to get it back from them. I had to go through a million different people and lawyers and sign contracts and all that shit and pay, and ironically pay them for a record that they had never paid us for.
Now, speaking of Dear You's legacy, I want to ask about this story I read. You're driving down the road, I assume in San Francisco, your daughter, I think, is behind the wheel. You see somebody with a Jawbreaker bumper sticker.
Mm-hmm.
And you pull next to them. You say, hey, that's my band. And the driver goes, oh shit. And then shows you a Dear You tattoo.
And you know what the craziest thing about that story?
Yeah.
It was Chris Isaac.
No way.
No, it wasn't. It wasn't. But we'll say just the way it is. Just cut that out. Cut out the no way. Cut out the no way and just let it ride. I was trying to think of a local celebrity that seems like, yeah, that might have happened, but
Chris Isaac seems believable.
It's believable. I mean, he surfs Ocean Beach, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It seems like he'd be in the mix somehow.
Do we have proof that he doesn't have a Dear You tattoo?
No, I think I do remember that happening, and I think the reason why that was written about was because it was really the first time that I think that my kid kind of was like, wait, what's this now? Like, because my kid didn't really know what was going on in Pop's old life, you know what I mean? And another thing that happened, we were fostering a dog and someone came over and they noticed I had a painting of the cover of one of our records on the wall, and the people that came to pick up the dog from us were like, wait a minute, is that Jawbreaker record? And I was like, yeah. And my kid was like, wait a minute, what's happening now? Like, it was kind of revelatory for her.
How long were you cool in her eyes?
I mean, I like to think I was cool before she knew, or they, both of my kids, before they knew that I did a band and stuff. But they just didn't know exactly, because their mom's kind of a rock star too. And they were just, you know, it was only when we played it, right, when they went to Riot Fest, that they were like, holy shit, what? Like, he wasn't just blowing smoke. Like, this was a thing at some point.
has it stuck? Are you still cool, or does that fade away quickly when you said, do your homework?
Well, my kids are cool, and they know cool. And I like to think I'm okay. But you know, you never know. They might just be rolling out right now. I could send this to them though, just rolling their eyes like, oh my God. They just didn't know. They were exposed to a lot of really great music as kids coming up, as like little babies even. And they know a lot of people in our world, you know, like they're tight with, you know, with like Ian and Henry are like, they're like uncles basically. But they just didn't, I just didn't really foist our band on them. Mm-hmm. Listen to this. I used to be cool, but like my wife was one of those OG DC people. So they came up knowing all those Fugazi guys and all them. And they probably just didn't think anything of it, honestly.
Yeah.
They were just like, oh yeah, whatever. Some adults do that. Some adults go make noise.
That's strange. I can't imagine growing up that way.
Yeah, it's a trip, right? But yeah, that's yes, yep, that's true. That did happen when I drove up on somebody and they had a sticker on the car. It wasn't like something that happened every day. I think it was kind of a novel thing. That's why that person was writing about it.
The time.
Thank you for listening to In Defense of Ska. To support the show, sign up for our Patreon. Intro and outro music by Slow Gherkin from the EP Lives. Additional music by Dan P. and the Bricks. Please rate and review the podcast and tell a friend. Follow at In Defense of Ska on social media. The book In Defense of Ska by Aaron Carnes is available from Clash Books. Order it online. Chris Reeves of SPI is our editor. This is your co-host, Adam Davis of Omnigon, leaving you by saying ska now more than ever. You're not punk, and I'm telling everyone, Aaron Carnes, that you're not punk.
You're ska.
I'm ska, so.
That was dope.
Yeah.
Hey, so if you were in one of the Gilman bands, and you know who I'm talking about, and you listened to this episode and you enjoyed what we did, reach out. We'd love to have you on the show.
Yeah.
And Aaron.
Yes.
I almost forgot, but I can't because we bring it up every week.
Yeah.
This conversation continues over on our Patreon.
It is. Wow. You know, if you thought that first part was good, you are at the second part. It's going to blow your mind.
Ooh-wee. You can't wait. So, $5, you'll be supporting this podcast. You'll be listening to these episodes ad-free.
Mm.
You will have access to our archive of other discussions.
Yes.
You'll have access to our Discord, where we talk with other fans of the podcast about all things ska-related.
And you know what, too? We don't say this often in our little pitch, but we have special monthly bonus episodes. They are off topic, or they are usually a different approach to the kind of episodes we do.
We also have other perks up there. There's a tote bag with our logo on it.
Yes.
There's an enamel pin.
Ooh.
You know, go get yourself something. Treat yourself.
Yeah.
You're special. We'll see you next week. We're not going to tell you who the guest is, but you should just subscribe and show up.
Yeah, you should extra subscribe, not knowing who it is.
Subscribe twice.